Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
Welcome to this episode of Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, your host. And today in the tower, I've even included my sidekick and partner in crime, David Ball.
Well, hello, good to be here.
David is here because another David is here, David Crane.
Hi, great to be here.
David, it's so good to have you.
Dr. David Crane.
Dr. David Crane is here. And those of you who know the Crystal Cathedral or Christ Cathedral know that Crane is a big deal here because our beautiful bell tower is that houses the Arvilla Schuller Carillon is named after the Crane family. It's Crane Tower. So because we already know that name, it's really quite handy because let me tell you, little radio listeners, you are going to know the name of David Crane if you don't already in a very short time, because David, among all of the other things that we're going to talk about today, is the author of the new book about the Hazel Wright organ. So, David, thank you, first of all, for accepting that huge challenge. It's a big deal, and a lot of work and a lot of research, and you're here in town to begin that research, to begin to interview people like Fred Swan and all the rest.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a pleasure to be involved with a project like this. I mean, one of the great, great organs in the country, played by people like Fred Swan and Richard Unfried.
And David Ball.
And David Ball. Yeah, let's not forget David.
Can't wait.
But no, it's a project I'm really happy to be a part of. I think it's going to be just an outstanding instrument and an outstanding venue when it goes in.
Well, let's talk more about David and find out who he is and what qualified him to write such a prestigious book. Well, let me tell you, he's as a teacher, recitalist, church musician, and even a radio personality of his very own. He hosts a show, and you live now in Dayton.
Dayton, yep.
And so you have a radio program several hours a day, right?
Yeah, 10 to 2 every weekday. I'm on the air, and I also pick the music for the rest of the live hours. So it's about 70 hours a week of music that
I'm responsible for. Oh, my
goodness. Wow.
We can barely pick 4 songs for our show here. And you are really working your brains out here. But you're a full-time church musician as well?
Part-time, but sometimes it feels like full-time.
Well, Dr. Crane has his DMA from Juilliard, and that's where he knew David. David was getting his bachelor's as David Crane was getting his doctorate.
Yeah, exactly the same time as Dr. Crane was studying for his doctorate, and I actually took his organ lit class. It was a very legendary class with me, Michael Hay, and Greg Zellick.
So some really notable organists in our country, all studying with David Crane. So it's really great to have you here on the campus. I can't wait to see some of your work begin to be produced. We have a lot of music to talk about because primarily you're a musician first, but you also write program notes. I know you write Paul Jacobs because that's how we found you, David.
Off of the Granny Looming album.
Yeah, Paul kind of got me into that. I've written a couple sets of liner notes for him, and I do most of his program notes now.
For concerts?
Yeah. Yeah, and some just for Juilliard, wind ensemble. I've done the commencement programs now a couple years in a row.
Wow. And do you enjoy that kind of research?
I do.
Tell us yet.
Oh yeah, no, of course. Yeah, no, I find those kind of projects really, really wonderful. I've always loved writing. It's something I don't get to do enough of, unfortunately. But when I do, it's really enjoyable. So
well, and for us, it was really important that you were not only a writer of great respect, but also a musician. That's a big part of this. The Hazel Wright organ is such a famous instrument. Certainly not the largest, only the fifth largest in the world.
Oh, wow.
But
I'm leaving.
Yes. We're trying hard we just had in the studio a few weeks ago, the guy from West Point.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yes, Williams. Right.
Williams was here. And, you know, he is the third largest organ.
Well, that one
in the
keeps
world.
Getting bigger. I mean, in a couple more decades, it'll be the largest.
Well, we're trying hard to keep up and do our best. But the Hazel Wright organ is certainly the most famous organ in the world because of the Robert Schuller Hour Power.
Right.
And, you know, 50 million viewers a week worldwide. So we have people just calling every day and coming every day. about the organ. You know, they just the hotel blocks are sold out. I mean, it is going to be crazy bananas here in May when we dedicate the organ. And at that same weekend, we're going to have the new book, and David will be here to sign the book. The preface is being written by Fred Swan. So it's really going to be great, filled with wonderful pictures. There's such a rich history of this organ. It's just beyond all telling. Well, we're going to talk about that in a future segment, but let's talk about David. So where on earth do you start to become a radio DJ and organist and recitalist and teacher and all the rest of it?
Well, I mean, the first thing was organ. I started that when I was still in high school, and I think like a lot of people, like I got a job doing it.
Were you a pianist first?
I was, yeah. But I grew up on Long Island, and like a lot of areas, trained organists are in fairly short supply. So anybody with a keyboard background was
right.
I decided I would take a couple of lessons to figure out what I was doing, and it kind of took off from there.
Yes, all the way to a doctorate at Juilliard.
Right. The other stuff kind of came later. Obviously the teaching was part of what I intended to do with the doctorate, but the radio job just kind of fell in my lap through various connections that I made in Southwest Ohio. I moved out there to teach at Wittenberg. I've now moved to Wright State, but still basically the same area. I'm happy to be there. It's a great little enterprise. There are not a lot of independent nonprofit classical stations left.
Well, both David and I were in St. Louis. David grew up there, and I was there for 18 years, and we saw our one and only classical station go under.
It was right. So sad.
Right. Yeah. So sad, and I did a lot of stuff with the radio station there, which is how I kind of got into this. Mm-hmm. I would go and do little shticks for my concert series and interview people that would come into town, and I just loved doing that, and the people there were great. The difference between a classical station that was NPR, where you couldn't have any ads,
right,
or you would have a mention, or the
underwriters. Yeah.
And that was kind of really my introduction from New York and from Pittsburgh. They were both NPR stations. So moving to St. Louis and hearing all these ads for concerts and interviews with people, and I just loved it.
Right. Well, it builds the community around these local radio stations. It brings the classical community together.
Well, and it really brought people to classical concerts. Mm-hmm. You know, it just kind of played in the background at doctor's offices, but all of a sudden you're hearing John Romero talk about some great group that was coming to the cathedral. And, you know, people really felt like, because I was the voice of all that they knew me. You know, I mean, they'd come up to me at concerts and go, "Oh, it's so great to see you again." Well, I've never met them in my life, you know, but they really did. We had a partnership there. Because it was my voice on the radio, and they really loved hearing about the concerts. And I think that's what a local station like that can do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then the community has been great about supporting it. I mean, we operate in the black every year. We're not, you know, running up a ton of debt. So it's a great little enterprise.
Good
for
you. And I'm sure a big part of that is you being there.
Well, I do what I can.
So let's back up just a little more. So you played the organ, started in high school, and then where?
Then to Oberlin for my undergrad. I studied with David Bowe, who was there forever, from the early 60s through, I think he retired just after I left in 2007. Wonderful, wonderful teacher, and a great place to study organ. I think Oberlin must have more pipe organs per capita than anywhere else in the world.
Well, and definitely a certain bent, you know. I mean, the people that study there are very scholarly. At least that's the outside impression to a boy who didn't go there. But I know my wife applied there and was accepted and ended up going to the University of Michigan. But everybody that looks at Oberlin, at least from the outside, thinks, oh, okay, scholarship. And maybe that's what led you more in the teaching vein. And
yeah, I actually, part of why I went there was to get two undergraduate degrees. They have a dual degree program. So I actually have a BA in politics that I never use for anything. But
that well, except your radio show, you probably say some wonderful political things.
No,
Lord,
no.
Oh, boy.
We're under strict orders to never mention ever. Anything occurring in the real world.
Okay. Well, that's what music is supposed to be, is take us somewhere
else. Right.
And that's hopefully what we do for folks. So you finished your bachelor's degrees at Oberlin?
I did, yeah. And then I went to Iowa for my master's, University of Iowa in Iowa City. Again, I studied with a teacher kind of at the end of their career. I was lucky to get in on the end of his career, Delbert Disselhorst was there from the 70s.
And was that your organ prof?
He was, yeah, for three semesters. My last semester I was with the guy that's there now, which is Greg Hand. And he's an excellent teacher too, but I was really blessed to study with both David and Delbert. I mean, not only were they phenomenal teachers, but the amount of accumulated knowledge over their two careers
amazing,
is, oh yeah, yeah. And it's all at their fingertips. I mean, that's one of the things that I aspire to is to just be able to call to mind things that happened, you know, 30 years ago.
Well, that's what happens with old guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it
David,
is...
David, not a word out of you. Right? I'm always reminiscing away, and then I go, oh, but they're dead. Okay, so... It's tough to get old. I'm sorry, folks. But and then you went on to Juilliard for just your doctorate, not
right, just my doctorate. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been actually a decade this year since I started at Juilliard. 2009 was my first year with Paul.
Well, what a career. Well, we're going to hear a lot more about that, and we want to talk certainly more about the Hazel Wright organ. We have a lot more with David Crane, but it's time for music. Tell us a little bit about the first piece that we're going to hear.
So the first piece is actually the first movement of the fifth trio sonata by Bach, the C major trio sonata. I recorded it actually just a few months ago at the church where I play now, which is St. George's Episcopal in Dayton. They've got a beautiful little two-manual Fisk Opus 94 from the late 1980s. It does really, really well for Bach, especially the more intimate pieces like the trio sonatas. So this is the first movement of Sonata number 5 in C.
Here's a little Bach, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. That was a beautiful piece by David Crean playing a Bach trio sonata for us. David is an incredible musician and the author of the new book about the Hazel Wright organ. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. But we just arrived at Juilliard as we're going through David's career here. And you did some remarkable things besides teaching David Ball.
that was the highlight.
I'm sure it was. but perhaps there were one or two other things at Juilliard while you were there. How long to get your doctorate?
They only give you 5 years at Juilliard, so they make a point of pushing people through pretty quickly. It's not the kind of place where you can just keep paying your matriculation fee and go forever. No, 5 years is the max, and most people do take the max if you finish earlier, but 5 years is typically the time. So, yeah, I graduated with David in 2014.
Tell a bit about your dissertation project. I found that fascinating.
So it actually kind of evolved pretty substantially over a period of time. It was originally going to be about programs, about organ recital programs in the late 19th, early 20th century, kind of the boom period of the American organ.
In the New York area?
In the New York area, because mm-hmm. The New York Public Library has just an incredible amount of source material on that, much of it never even explored or indexed, just boxes and boxes and boxes.
Wow.
So, yeah, so I pretty quickly realized that was more than a dissertation topic. And then I narrowed it down to like three or four people, and that even that was too much. So then I narrowed it down to just one person, and it became more of a life and works study. And the guy I chose was Samuel P. Warren, who was at Grace Episcopal in New York from the 1870s through the 1890s. He was one of the great organists in America, unfortunately largely forgotten now. Clarence Eddy is the one that gets remembered from that time period, because he was
starting the guild and all that.
Yeah, and he was a little bit younger, and he lived more into the period of recorded sound. So there's more of a record of...
Is there any recorded sound of this guy?
No, there's nothing.
Nothing?
No.
So how did you even begin to narrow it down to this one?
I did a lot of looking at old periodicals to see who got the most press, basically. And he was really the guy from the 1860s onward in New York. And then...
Would that have been in an organist journal or in a paper? Or where would you find
this? No, this is actually even before... This is before the specifically organ journals, like American Organist and Diapason. I was looking in places like Dwight's Journal of Music, which was really the first American music periodical. Also the Musical Courier, which ran for like 60 years under various names. Periodicals that really actually aren't even indexed at the moment. So it was a lot of looking at microfilm.
Well, that was a hefty project. Wow.
It was, yeah. It ended up being very, very research intensive, probably more than I had anticipated. Yeah. But, I mean, it was a very rewarding project. I mean, it really honed my research skills. And the doctoral committee saw fit to award me the doctoral prize for it. So that was a nice acknowledgement.
And was that the Richard French Award?
It was, yeah.
And you know, Richard was a teacher at Union Seminary, mm-hmm, as well as, did he also teach at Juilliard?
I think he did. Yeah, he taught, boy, I should know exactly what he taught, but he did teach at Juilliard for a period of time.
One of the things I was looking forward to in going to Union Seminary was to study with Richard French, mm-hmm, you know, and then that didn't come to fruition because the school closed on me.
Oh, wow.
I was in the class that it closed, so I didn't get that honor, but, you know, everybody knew that name, mm-hmm, you know, in the 70s, in the early 70s, he was it, you know,
right.
So to receive that award is really, it was wonderful.
It was nice. Yeah, I was really humbled to receive that. There have been a lot of outstanding dissertations that have become books that have won that award. And
has yours become a book?
No, I'm kind of working on it intermittently as I have time.
Well, just put it aside for now. You've got the Hazel Wright
book. Yeah, right, that's the main project right now, yeah.
Organists from the 1800s come and go, but the Hazel Wright.
Yeah, luckily the Hazel Wright's organs history begins in the 20th century, and there's not microfilm involved.
It should not be so horrible, but it's going to be rich, and we're going to talk about that in our next segment. And so here you are with a dissertation on someone from the 1800s. Where do you go with that? What happens next?
In terms of career
yeah,
progression, well, my main goal was always to teach at a university, to teach organ. And, you know, I'd be happy teaching theory and musicology. Jobs are in short supply.
Or history and history?
Music history, musicology, theory. I'm happy to do any of those things. But full-time organ jobs are in very short supply right now, as you probably know. Actually, before I graduated from Juilliard, I moved out to Ohio to work at Wittenberg as the chapel music director, the university organist, and faculty in the music department.
Which is a pretty famous school. A lot of famous people actually went there, organists.
Yeah, especially in Lutheran circles. It's a Lutheran school, and a lot of the big Lutheran musicians of the 80s and 90s and today went there, like Robert Hobby is an alum.
Yes.
Wayne Wold is a Wittenberg alum. So they had some good people pass through there.
They certainly did.
Yeah. And then I kind of migrated down to Wright State eventually, which is about 20 miles southwest in Dayton.
So you found that to be your permanent home. And did you take a church job in addition to your teaching right away?
Well, when I was at Wittenberg, my church job was the college chapel.
Right.
But now that I'm at a state school, I work at an Episcopal church in Dayton. It's a really nice place to work.
So there's no university organist position tied to the...
No. It's just music faculty.
And do you have a good batch of organ students?
I've got two at the moment, which is two more than they've had for decades.
Wow.
Nobody can actually remember the last one before the two that are there now, so it's improving. We're working on getting the facilities going, but it's nice. I've had several harpsichord students there in years past, and I've taught some really rewarding theory classes there, like the counterpoint seminar, and Currently, I'm teaching ear training and graduate research. That's another course I'm happy to be doing.
And you were mentioning ear trainings at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
That's really mean.
And it's the only,
very brutal.
And it's the only section, too, so you don't even have a choice.
You can't take the afternoon class.
No.
Well, that's great. And tell us a little bit about what your church shop is like.
It's actually the largest Episcopal church in Dayton in terms of weekly attendance. We've got about a 30-voice choir when everybody is there. The organ is really, really wonderful. It's the only substantial tracker organ in Dayton. As I mentioned, it's a Fisk from the 80s. Interesting instrument. It's three divisions on two manuals. So there's a
floating one?
The swell and the Brustwerk share the top manual, and you can control the air to them with ventils.
Wow.
So you can have one or the other or both. Both isn't really a good idea, but basically one or the other. But it's a beautiful organ. It's voiced immaculately for the room.
And are you still out playing recitals and doing other things?
I am, yeah. As I have time, I'm playing mostly in kind of the Midwest area. I did the Poulenc Concerto with the Dayton Bach Society a couple of years ago. That was really great.
Well, I'm sure Paul is very proud of Paul Jacobs, your teacher from Juilliard, is very proud of all the great work you're doing there.
A lot of it started with the opportunities that David and I were lucky enough to get going to a school like Juilliard. I mean, playing in the Bach Stock concert on QXR a couple of years ago.
We're going to hear a little bit about that just a little while.
Yeah, I mean, getting to meet and collaborate with some of the best young musicians in the world. It's humbling and it's also stimulating. So
must be frightening to have that kind of competition sitting around. You know, very different from, I experienced that at Westminster. You know, it's so many organ majors and they were all phenomenal. I was there playing chopsticks. But
that's the way I felt when I got there.
Well, it is daunting, you know, and you always feel like, well, I'm, you know, they're so great and I'm not. But when I went to the University of Pacific, there were just six of us, you know, so it was much smaller. Mm-hmm. And there were organ minors, but of the main organists. So it was much easier to be on top of the heap, you know, or like with your two.
Right.
But, wow, it must have been frightening at Juilliard. At least you're coming into the doctorate level. Little freshman David.
Poor David.
Well, I mean, sitting in those keyboard classes, you know, the person, now that I'm a little older now, the people who were sitting next to me in the keyboard classes playing piano just won the Tchaikovsky and the
competition.
And here I am, you know. I mean, I'm at Christ Cathedral and very proud of it. But
I mean, the organ department, I think, was really pretty tight when David and I were there, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
look at us. We're friends. And he was a doctoral student much older than I was. And we were we're fast friends.
We're all much older than you.
Here we go.
But, you know, I think there are a lot of stories that kind of float around in the musical world about Juilliard that are kind of fanciful about, you know, students sabotaging each other. And I never really saw any of that there. It's really pretty collegial.
Well, I credit all of that to Paul Jacobs myself.
Yeah.
You know,
he created, I mean, at the end of David's audition, he picked up the phone and called me immediately as David's former teacher. I was actually in Detroit, ready to walk on to begin a choral festival, and I backed up. People are already applauding.
Just a
moment, please. And you know, I didn't walk out, and I stopped and talked to Paul for a few minutes. But you know, I mean, it's like, what can I do to get David to come here? And you know, we really have a great family. I promise I'll take good care of him. And you know, there's that kind of family there that I didn't find, you know, at every place. Mm-hmm. I auditioned to lots of schools. Paul wasn't teaching when I auditioned at Juilliard, but at Eastman, when I played my audition, you could have opened the door and 25 students would have fallen through the door.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just one of those. There were so many, and who's coming now?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of backdoored my way into Westminster because I was going to be at Union, but Westminster was just filled with incredible people.
I mean, those were probably the days with 50 and 60 person organ programs.
We had so many. When I went there, there were no teachers available.
Wow.
I actually got to choose a teacher and chose John Weaver from Juilliard and Curtis. But it was really the heyday of organ. There were so many. And then they all went off and took the big jobs all over the country. And you must be so proud when you look at the Juilliard list of organ graduates. They're all in every big job, from St. Thomas to Christ Cathedral to St. Patrick's.
Yeah.
I mean, every single place, you know, is filled with a wonderful Juilliard graduate.
So
there's no way to say that that's not our top school still, because they're all in our top jobs. Ben Sheen.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And Paul is a wonderful teacher. I mean, I loved studying with David and Delbert, but Paul was the one that really kind of held my feet to the fire more about being a disciplined musician, which was something I definitely needed at the time.
Well, and that's something that he definitely is.
Oh,
you know, I've never seen a more disciplined musician. You know, you bring him to town, he goes, now, if you can get a cheaper room without a television, I don't watch TV, you know. I'll just be there practicing.
Or just somebody's house within walking distance of the church.
I'm good to go. You know, he is beyond all telling. And I've known Paul since he was a little 16-year-old kid when I was working in the Diocese of Pittsburgh. So, you know, it's fun to have seen all these great musicians come up. And that's part of that being old thing.
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm starting to get in on that now. I've got like former students like David at Christ Cathedral, and Greg is at the Madison Symphony. So it's starting to come
a little bit. You have a lot more gray hair to accumulate before that. But it's time for more music. Let's hear a little bit more. Now, this is a composer I don't know. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, not a lot of people know about him. He's actually a composer I ran across quite a bit in my dissertation research. His name is Louis Thiele. He was a German composer in the early 19th century. He must have had just a prodigious technique. I mean, much, much, much more difficult than anything else being written at the time.
Wow.
He was based in Berlin at the Parochial Kirche, and Americans that went to study in Berlin all learned his music. They came back, and it was a staple of their recital programs until really about the early 20th century, and it kind of fell out of fashion.
I've never heard that name.
Yeah, some of it is just blindingly difficult music, you know, stuff that's written on four staves because it just won't fit on three.
Yeah.
More black than white on the page. And,
wow.
But I think it's music that definitely deserves to be played, especially because there just isn't, other than Mendelssohn, there's not a lot of music from that time that organists play. So it's
sort of a precursor of Reger, is that where we are?
Yeah, that's a fair thing to say, especially in terms of virtuosity. Yeah, yeah.
Cargellert, all of those.
Right. Not quite as harmonically adventurous as Reger, but very extroverted in a virtuosic way.
All right, well, here's his composition, concert piece.
Yeah, it's not a very good title. He's got a couple that are just called concert piece. This is the concert piece in C minor.
And where'd you perform this?
This was at the Brick Church in New York City for my first
castle.
Oh yeah, an unbelievable organ. It's one of those organs where you just sit down and everything feels right,
everything
sounds
right.
It's just, yeah, you don't have to fight it at all.
And certainly Keith Toth was instrumental in making that organ so beautiful.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just fabulous. Well, we'll be right back. And guess what we're going to talk about next? The book on the Hazelwright organ. So stay tuned. This is John Romero, your host here at Music from the Tower. And I'm here with my sidekick, David Ball, Juilliard graduate as well. And we were visiting today with David Crean. So please stay tuned. We have a lot to tell you. Welcome back. This is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romeri. Today, visiting with David Crean, Dr. David Crean. And David is the author of the new book about the Hazel Wright organ. And I'm here with our organist, David Ball. So we're both anxious to hear all about what you plan for the book. The whole world is anxious to hear what's going into this book. I know you're here in town because you're going to interview folks like Richard Unfrey and Mark Fallander and Fred Swan. And you've also been in touch with the Rifati family.
Yeah, I've been in touch with the Rifati brothers, and they've got some material that they claim even you guys don't know about. So I'm eager to get my fingers on that and hear what that is.
And when I talked to Francesco about being able to share his email with you, he said, oh, yes, we have a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've been a regular Music from the Tower listener, you know that we've told some backstories before from Richard Unfried especially. You know, he described the night that they signed for the original Rifati for the Arboretum.
Right.
And, you know, everybody was so excited. It was going to be 115 ranks. But what the Rifatis didn't tell him was they had just signed for 116 ranks at Coral Ridge.
Oh.
And Richard Unfried describes how angry Reverend Schuller was that his organ was already trumped before it was even built, you know, so even by one stop as the biggest organ in America. But
he sure showed them.
Well, tell us a little bit about your process, the things you hope to put in there. I hope that they're going to be tons of pictures. I've been collecting away for you, David, and we have great pictures of even Hazel Wright herself receiving flowers from Mark Fallander, for example.
Well, I'm really indebted to you guys for the amount of material that you've already collected. I mean, it's saved a lot of work looking at, you know, newspapers and archives.
And we have to credit the Hazel Wright Society as well. The Hazel Wright Organ Society is a huge Facebook group, but they too have put so much material online. You know, and we're going to steal every bit of it. And we're trying not only to write this book, but to really have on our website the great history of the organ. We have two little parts on our website right now, the history of the Hazel Wright organ, with some wonderful pictures of when the Schulers were in the factory and, you know, all of that, and how it really is a composite organ of the Philharmonic Hall. And Richard, also on Richard's show, he talks about he and Schuller in Symphony Hall, and how Schuller went over and closed the lid and tapped on the top of it and said, "See you in Garden Grove."
Oh, boy.
You
know, I mean,
just all these dramatic things. And the tie, Richard Unfried went to, and did, of course, he couldn't get in to practice at Philharmonic Hall.
No.
So he went over to practice at Fred Swan's Riverside Church.
Sure.
Who
sure.
knew?
Right.
You know, so there's
it's a small world,
these
the
great
world.
Backstories of how all this came to be and how this great organ, and of course then there's all the Virgil Fox part.
Oh yeah.
There's driving over with the truck to the Bavard School of Music at USC, they went to take one rank, but there was another rank in the way, so they took them both. You know, all of these great stories. So I'm hoping it's just going to be a fascinating read of the complete history of Hazel.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important organ. It really needs to have, you know, a comprehensive, complete history of it from beginning to present. And that's what I really hope to provide with, you know, a real sense of chronology and context, especially. It's wonderful that Richard and Fred and Mark are here and willing to speak with me. That's so helpful.
Well, and we should also mention Chris Pardini, who was also one of the organists here. You know, there was just such a wealth of people that were part of this legacy.
Well, great American organists.
Like really. And having Fred Swan, the grandfather of all organists.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, having him here and having him still spearheading the project. He just played for David and I, and it just happened that Stephen Tharp was in town. So the three of us got to go sit in the pew and listen to Fred. He had it all pre-programmed out. Take us front on a little tour of the few divisions that are complete, that have been voiced. And it's just marvelous. The new acoustic in the room is beyond all telling.
The room is really stunning. This is my first time to the campus, so I never saw it without the quadrifoils, but it's really beautiful.
Well, it was always a magnificent piece of American architecture, but it had to just be so hot.
Oh, I can't even imagine without air conditioning.
Without all glass walls, huge door that opened up, which was kind of their trademark that you could come in your car and be outside and attend the service in a sense. But it just had to be because even with air conditioning and the quadrifoils, I find myself very hot in there.
There's plenty of sun.
But what also has changed, of course, is covering up that glass is the low frequencies have a whole new sound in the space. Mm-hmm. And because there is no carpeting or, you know, pew cushions or all those things that were taking away from the sound living in the space, now it's all marble and stone, and the quadrifoils have helped, and it's really quite a... But what it's been for the Rafatis is it's a whole new deal.
Right.
You know, so they're having to revoice all 17,000 pipes from scratch. Somebody said, well, are they like 50% done? And I said, well, probably more like 5%. You know?
Yeah, I mean, every single pipe has to be touched individually. It's not... I'm not sure people realize how labor-intensive that process is.
Well, especially on a huge instrument like that. Mm-hmm. We have 2 5 manual consoles that, you know, are...
Right, and the pipes in, you know, 4 separate corners. It's a lot to take in. It's a lot to consider when voicing how it's going to blend with the other parts of the organ in the room, how it sounds in this balcony, how it sounds in that balcony. It's a difficult project. But I'm sure they're doing a wonderful job. I can't wait to hear it when it's finished.
Well, so far, so good.
I'm so excited.
It was just absolutely gorgeous. And, of course, Fred, of all the organists in the world, knows exactly what you're
doing. Right,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about your process. How are you going about this? How on earth do you whittle all this down into one book that we can afford?
Well, I mean, Fred and Mark and Richard, I think, are helping a lot because there's so much of the history in their experiences and in their minds. So a lot of that information is coming from them. And, you know, I'm going to try to tell as comprehensive a story as possible, you know, going all the way back to probably to the inauguration of the instrument in Symphony Hall in New York when Virgil Fox and Catherine Crozier and E. Power Biggs did the three-person marathon.
Vacation.
Yeah, yeah. And that's nobody knew it at the time, but that was the beginning of the Hazelwright organ. So I want to start at the very beginning and then show, you know, exactly where things came from and who was responsible and who was involved and how it came to be and what kind of interesting and exciting stories happened along the way. 'Cause that's in some ways the most interesting part is the kind of human component behind it.
Yeah. And even to come up with the idea of taking these two great organs. I mean, here was this giant Rafati, 115 ranks sitting in the Arboretum. Now we have 82 ranks and it blows the windows out. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine this must have been, you know, just a big deal to put an organ that large here in suburban Los Angeles.
Right.
And it's just a bedroom community to have this big room with that organ. But then to have the idea of saying, well, let's combine that with a symphony organ in...
from New York, you know, from across the country.
Across the country. I mean, this was visionary thinking when you think about it. And to have the... So it really has 2 backstories, really.
Right.
You know, there's the great story of somehow... I mean, I know they were looking at Aeolian and Skinner and all sorts of other companies when the Schuller family chose, they had a little baby Wicks in there, you know, that was way too small for the room. And then they went to this gigantic Rafati. But there had to be steps along the way of, well, what company shall we get? You know, and I think Richard Unfried will be the one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He was the first organist after Arvilla Schuller herself. Mm-hmm. So well, here's little Dr. Schuller on the top of a candy stand, and his wife is the organist, you know. And so when they finally move into the church, she's the first one, but then she quickly moved off the bench. And along came Richard Unfried. And they were clever, you know. I mean, he was the let's try him out for an entire year, you know, part of the audition process. So it's a fascinating story. And then along comes Virgil Fox with the idea of putting all these together and then adding more.
Right.
You know, it's not like we took 100 ranks from here and 100 ranks from there. Well, let's add a third more, you know, and make it even bigger. To fill the Crystal Cathedral.
And that's combining parts from different organs like that is also a difficult undertaking because they're, you know, they're voiced in different styles and for different rooms, and to put them all together really, really requires an organist and a builder with a very good ear to actually get it to meld in some kind of coherent way.
Well, and I credit Richard and Fred for that, as well as the Rafatis. I mean, it was a challenge in such a room, in such a dead and wild room. Mm-hmm. You know, it was unwieldy. And Fred always talks about, I have cloudy pistons and rainy day pistons and sunny full right. sun pistons, and you couldn't use all of the organ together. And it will still be the case, except for about 7:30 at night. That's what we're gearing for, is 7:30 at night, when we have the major concerts, is when the entire organ will come into tune. And because, you know, our theory is that a major recitalist, whether it's Paul Jacobs or whoever it is going to want to showcase the whole instrument.
Oh, absolutely.
So we want it to be in tune at that moment. And sorry, David, but those of us who are parish organists will have to use selected divisions and not be able to couple this with that. And
you know, well, and for a service, you won't need the entire instrument.
No, of course not.
For a company inquiry, you just color it up a little bit. And
yeah, I mean, I'm sure the organ is going to benefit quite a bit from the climate control and from the quadrifoils.
Well, they're finding that it actually is creating some issues, because it used to be hot and then really hot, and now it's cool and really hot.
Oh, right.
You know, so the temperature variation is actually greater than it was before. It's not insurmountable, but it does create even a bigger span of time when this whole instrument is not going to be totally in tune.
Yeah, I mean, organs are difficult instruments to play and to build and to configure and to tune. I mean, it's a
and
difficult
then put
enterprise.
It in the glass house.
Oh yeah,
and,
right. That just adds one more
on top of each other. You know, the great cathedral in St. Louis. I had all these divisions right there by the choir, and air conditioning ducts running right into them, and then
50 feet up, there's a
50
hole
feet in the air was all the grate and the solo all exposed, and the swell.
Not to mention the organ a block away in the back and a block away on the side.
Yeah, so organs are tricky things, especially these mammoth instruments in great cathedrals.
Yeah, I mean that's what makes this one so special. Really, is that it works. You know, it's looking at it on paper, you would think, what in the world? But it works. It works as a beautiful, cohesive concert instrument and service instrument. And
to sit down at the console, like this row is Aeolian Skinner,
right.
And this row are Rafatis, and you know, so even dividing it that way, it isn't a normal layout like an organ that was just all put together and it's all going to work. You know, it's really independent instruments even within divisions.
Right.
Well, we certainly look forward to the dedication weekend, which is May 15, 16, 17 of 2020. And during that weekend, we're going to have book signings. David will be here to really wrap up what this process was like and tell us all about it. And certainly Fred Swan will be on hand, and Richard, all of them will be here, Mark Valander. So, you know, we're really looking forward to having a whole hour or so discussion about the organ and about what your findings were, and certainly having book signings, and we'll be interested to see what Fred has to write in the preface. And
I can't wait to read his preface.
It's going to be.
I mean, he's another one like Delbert and David. That's just a walking encyclopedia of organ history.
Well, and you know, if he hasn't played it or dedicated it, he knows of it.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Right,
and he knows
right.
every organist. You know, he is just a great person, and you know, his mind is so sharp, and he's still playing away. Mm-hmm. He's playing a festival here in just 2 weeks.
Wow.
You know, and just played beautifully for David and I a few weeks ago. It's a great thing. Well, speaking of playing, let's get back to you, David. We need more. Tell us a little bit about this Bach Marathon.
So actually, David and I were both involved in this. It was put on by WQXR in New York, I guess about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They originally wanted Paul to repeat his Bach Marathon.
Playing all the Bach works.
Yeah, playing them all in one go, back to back.
We already mentioned on this program that he's an absolute crazy man.
And so, right.
And we love him dearly.
Like, who does that?
Well, he told them that he was too old to do that again. I mean, he's, at the time, he was all of like 38 or 39, but
poor thing.
Yeah, well, he said that he would curate it and participate, but that he wanted current and former students to be involved, and they said fine. So we all got an hour or a portion of an hour to perform a segment of the complete works, which
did
was...
Did you get to choose which part you
We
put?
Did not.
So you were assigned.
We were assigned, so I ended up with the first segment at 7 a.m.
The honor of opening the whole thing.
It was, yeah. That part was great.
You always start with the best.
Well, of course.
Best foot forward.
But, you know, for like a month beforehand, I got up at like 4:30 or 5 just to train my body to be... alert,
sort of alert
at 7, because yeah. You know, rolling out of bed to play Bach Preludes and Fugues doesn't usually work out very well.
Yes, so the first mass should be one hand with a coffee cup
and right.
playing the right,
right.
You know, play the melody and drink.
But I mean, there were people there. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't empty. There were 50, 60 people there.
Wow.
Actually, by the time I was done, it was really pretty full. And by the time
I have to start so early just to get them all in.
Well, yeah, I mean, it ended at like 2 in the morning. Even starting at 7, it still went for almost 24 hours.
And so when did Paul deign to roll in?
Paul got the 8 o'clock p.m. program. He had kind of the featured time slot.
Nice.
And he played a lot of the favorites, like the
5-6-5.
Yeah, the D minor Toccata and Fugue. Pieces he's played
the wedge,
for decades. Yeah.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here you're playing the G minor fugue, yes?
Yeah, this is one of the maybe lesser known fugues. It's the G minor fugue from the prelude BWV 536, prelude and fugue of Bach, on the Kleiss organ at St. Peter's in the City Corps building in New York.
Yes, that's such a cool building, the way that chapel
oh, yeah,
is
it's,
right
it's
underneath
great.
There. All right, and we'll be back and finish up our visit with David Crean. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to The Tower. This is Music from The Tower with John Romeri and today's guest, Dr. David Crean, and cohort in crime, David Ball, our wonderful organist here. And the reason David has joined us, because he and Dr. Crean were both classmates at Juilliard. Well, we are so excited about the book. I can't tell you. We could do all four segments about
yeah,
the book.
Yeah, it's going to be a wonderful project.
It really is. And of course, we'll have you back on the radio when you can tell us all about your findings, and you're just really beginning your explorations, mm-hmm. and it's thrilling. What else is coming up for you? What other projects you have in the wind?
Well, I'm one of these days going to get around to writing an organ literature textbook. I really do want to make that happen. When I taught the class that David was in at Juilliard, I pretty much started from scratch, writing my own curriculum.
But don't you think everybody does? I've never seen a there's nobody that has a real syllabus for what organ lit looks like. And it depends on the bent of the teacher. Mm-hmm. Like I had Joan Lippincott one semester. Mm-hmm. Well, she had her own. Then the next semester, I had Dr. William Hayes. And so, of course, his big thing is studying with Marshall was all French. Mm-hmm. You know, so that whole semester we just dove into one one French piece after the other. But, you know, there wasn't any methodical, let's go from here to there.
Yeah, and I've always thought that's kind of a problem. You know, organists develop a really in-depth knowledge of a certain segment of the repertoire depending on who and when they studied with.
Right.
And part of it is just that the repertoire is just so massive. I mean, you're talking about 800 years worth of music.
Right. But to have a survey course that really is sort of telling you, like, you know, to have done this for 46 years and never have heard that name, the piece we heard earlier, that shows that somebody forgot to tell me about that guy.
Well, that's what was so amazing about David Crean's course. It was comprehensive from the very beginnings of the organ all the way until current things. Like we were listening to recordings of all these things. It was very comprehensive.
I don't know how amazing David found it at the time when we were talking about, you know, 14th century codices and things like that.
But we covered them. We did cover all of that. It was very well laid out.
And there are other classes, you know, we had early French literature class. We had, you know, where you're really studying in depth one style of playing and all the things that go with that. But often the organ lit courses that I took or even had at Duquesne and other places were just really based on the artistry of the teacher.
Right.
You know, and their interests or what they were playing that year in their recitals or whatever it was, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a comprehensive course. So wouldn't it be a great gift to all of us for you to produce that book after the Hazel book?
Afterwards, for sure. Yeah.
Priorities here.
Yeah. I mean, the information is there. It's just scattered in a million different places.
Right.
There's great work on early music. There's great work on 19th century and French and Bach and 20th century, but it's all very specialized and not in the same place. And, you know, for sure, in previous generations, there have been people more qualified than myself to write something like this, but it just hasn't happened. And I think it's past time for there to be
It has just in segments. You know, when you think of the early French book that was written. And you know, there are little bits of it all over the place. And then there are organ survey books, you know, of just the instruments.
Oh, yeah, right.
But not really the rep. And, you know, I've said this on the show before, but as a student back in the 70s, you know, you'd race to Tower Records, and there'd be a little, about 4 inches worth of LPs, and it was never a piece you were learning, but there they were. And now here it trots along David Ball, organist extraordinaire, and he can go anywhere in the world and listen to 6 different performances of any piece he's ever worked on.
Right.
You know, so it's a whole different world. Will your book be that kind of a? Will there be musical examples? Will it be a podcast? How will it work?
I mean, the way I've kind of envisioned it is more like a textbook. I mean, there will certainly be audio components and, you know, specific more in-depth analyses of key pieces.
Yeah,
probably that'll all have to be online because that's just the way
it is
trending.
Take you somewhere else,
right?
Yeah,
right.
For David's class, we had to go to the library and listen to these things.
Right,
but we did listen. I remember meeting Kimberly Marshall, and I said, "Hey, it was great to at Juilliard we listened to your recording of the Roberts Bridge Codex," and she was it was just amazing that, you know, the vastness of the knowledge we got out of that class.
Yeah. So,
well, we'll wait for your book. That's going to be great. What other things?
Well, I'm always working.
Or we have you captured here in the studio.
I'm always working on building the program at Wright State. It's not a place that's had a really robust organ program in the past. We do have a little instrument in the concert hall, but it needs some help.
And sometimes you need that instrument to rally around the students, you know, to attract the students.
You do. I mean, the organ is so dependent on the instrument. You can't just kind of it's not like the oboe where you can pack up your oboe and go to somebody's house and teach them. It just doesn't work that way. So you've got to have something to use to teach to attract good students.
Well, we're certainly hoping that, you know, the organ here at Christ Cathedral will be one of those catalysts for Southern California. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be a place where students will come and where we'll have an organ scholar program. David already has amazing, young, promising organists just, you know, barely out of grade school, and they're playing these huge things already, playing for us all the time. It's those kind of instruments that do it, you know, so we'll have to get you a fabulous instrument there. Organ donors out there,
you know,
don't forget.
Yeah, that's kind of a new world for me. I don't have a lot of experience with fundraising yet, but I'm gonna have to learn.
They're all the things that Paul and my teachers forgot to teach us, but it's essential, you know.
Right.
I mean, I've had to raise the money for the piano and for the rest of the organ fund, and you know, it's just part of what we do, you know. And because we're in great places, we're lucky enough to be able to have some success. Well, David, it's absolutely a pleasure to get to meet you. Every now and then I have people that I don't know at all in the studio, and I love it because I have no idea what's coming out of your mouth next. You know? Sometimes you ask a question, but you know exactly what they're going to say, and I didn't today. But you really took us some very interesting places.
No, I'm happy to be here.
We are thrilled that you were kind enough to accept our invitation to write this book.
They're thrilled that you asked me.
We thank Paul Jacobs for that recommendation. Mm-hmm. You know, we said, Paul, who are we going to? Well, there's only one. You know, so he took us right there. All right. Well, we're going to hear a little bit more, and this time a little bit of Litez.
Yeah, Gaston Litez, one of the great organists of the 20th century, a blind French organist. There have been quite a few over the centuries.
Certainly have.
Yeah. Vierne is maybe the best known.
Sure.
Marshall. Langlais.
Cabazon.
Well, he was Spanish, but...
Still, blind organist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it goes back really to the very beginning. I mean Francesco Landini was blind. He's the first organist that there's any written record of.
I noticed the eye.
Oh, here we go.
But, yeah, so this is probably Litez's best known work, at least in America. The Prelude à Danse Fugue. It's a really fun piece. I've been telling David he needs to learn it. It's the prelude is kind of jaunty, and the fugue has a really unusual theme that builds and goes to some really unexpected places.
Is it part of the sets of pieces? Or
no, it's independent.
Independent.
It's by itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, what a great pleasure to meet you, to have you here with us on the campus for a few days, and to have you in May when the book is finished. It's going to be great. This has been Music from the Tower with John Romeri and David
Ball.
And we are so happy to have David Crean here. And as always, we end our show with pleading with you to go out and listen to some great music in live performance. And someday we'll be hearing a David Crean.
Especially organ music.
Organ music.
However good the recording engineer, there's just no way to perfectly capture an organ on record. It's something you have to experience in person, especially an organ like Hazel.
Yes, you must come when Hazel is beginning to play it on her own.
Hazelback.org.
Yes, and you'll find all the information about Hazel's rededication at hazelsback.org, and you can find all of the information about the music program here at Christ Cathedral, including David's podcast when it's finished, at christcathedralmusic.org. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time, next week, on the next episode of Music from the Tower.